good money. So just to show you that, okay, I remind you the activity on Wiki that is severely lacking, actually. I just seen that there are not many contributions, so this is quite a problem. So please do it. There is something on epigenomics, but that's it. So you have to, please, to increase your participation in the Wiki, okay? So the other thing is that, especially because actually I will ask you something about methodology at the exam, so if you don't contribute, you don't study, no way to prepare the exams, please. So anyway, the other thing about the Moodle site is that I open activity for chapter 2, that is here, so activity 6. We'll open today at 1 p.m. and we stay for 1 week. So. Okay, so we can close it now and go to the lesson here. So what we can talk about today is this story about programming. This is a quite important subject of our course because, of course, it concerns many of the other disciplines, like, for example, development, cancer, and general disease, cellular differentiation, and many other stories. And even in the very last slide, you will see also pharmacologists. We see that there is kind of big interest. And actually, the title could be epigenetic program. And sorry, this is just to skip. Okay, so what we have seen in the first lesson, chapter one, is that we have learned that epigenetic marks to histones, as well as CpG methylation, are reproduced over the new DNA. This was the last lesson subject, right? All right. And also that this reproduction, let's say, is something that happens during DNA replication, but also a little bit later when the cells actually goes through mitosis and then to G1. And then there is still some activity try to reconstitute all the histone marks that were in the mother, okay? Mother DNA, sorry. Okay, so mother cell. So this kind of coping of pre-existing post-translational modification to histones, right? Coping to adjacent, novel, naive histones is something like that is something like spreading. I mean, you have a mark, and this mark will spread on novel nucleosomes, right? So one of the questions today, that the first part of the lesson today we ask is, is this spreading a general principle of heterochromatin? In other words, whenever you have a region in which there is heterochromatin, has this heterochromatin a tendency to spread to the other flanking regions? Okay? And this is quite important because it will define what we call domains. You remember heterochromatic domains, euchromatic domains, or whatever. So I will go through very old genetic research, not because it's such an important thing in biology today, but just because it gives you ideas about principles. Okay, so in the pre-genomic era, so when we were not able to make, you know, this kind of chip-seq and whatever else, there were a few models the scientists were studying, and essentially they were actually in model organisms, like, of course, Saccharomyces, that is very easy to manipulate, or Caenorhabditis, or Drosophila. Drosophila has been the historical model for geneticists. Why? Because it reproduces an incredible rhythm. Each Drosophila makes thousands of eggs, so you can have thousands of embryos and you can study mutations and whatever, very easy to do, okay? And they are very easy to grow in the lab. You have big flasks with a agar on the bottom, and then they grow like crazy. So it's a very, it was and it is now also a very important model for genetics. And Drosophila, actually the insects are a very low level of CpG methylation. Okay, so this is a different, important difference if you compare with mammals. Okay, and this low level of cytosine methylation is actually a role in transposon silencing, and that's it. So probably this is an important difference to remember. But there was a mutant, and you know, the geneticists were studying Drosophila, just irradiating these poor guys with X-rays or whatever radiation, and then making mutations and studying mutations. There was an interesting phenotype sometimes that was this white mutation that is a phenotype in the eye of Drosophila. So please just take a look of the Drosophila eye. This is not from Star Wars, it's just an head of a fly. So this is a composite eyes. Probably you know that each of the dots here is a single ommatid. Okay, so that's a fission itself. And actually, the problem is that this is the normal phenotype, so it's red, everything. And when you look at this white mutation, it's something like this patches. Okay, so please note that it's not a pink. If you had one ommatid red and the other ommatid white, you have a kind of pink, uniform pink coloration. Actually, it's not that one. You have patches in red and patches in white. So it's a kind of variegation, they call. Okay. So this phenotype has been called PEV because a simple story. Because what was the mutation causing this phenotype is not inactivation of the gene determining the red color. Okay. But was a translocation. So usually this white gene stays here in the chromosome, and in this mutant it has been translocated to a pericentromeric position. What is in the centromeric region? All of you know, it's a constitutive heterochromatin, right? So this gene has been translocated close, not inside, but close adjacent to the constitutively heterochromatic centromeric region. And what happens now? It happens that actually you have that this chromatin will spread a little bit inside the chromosome branch and will inactivate the gene. Sometimes, not always, sometimes. Okay, we have an explanation in a few slides. Then go to another famous phenotype, is the this ADE2 gene. Okay, this is the adenosine, the deaminase gene, and in Saccharomyces cerevisiae, if the ADE gene is translocated close to the telomeric region here, this is telomeric region, and again you know that telomeric region is constitutively heterochromatic. Okay, again you have, this is a colony, okay, and you give a pre dye to the cells, and they will elaborate with this ADA enzyme. Okay, so some cells are able to elaborate, so they express ADA2, and some are not able to do it. Again, this is a variegated phenotype because it's not a pink story. Okay, so what happens here is again that this ADA2 goes close to the telomeric silent chromatin, okay, heterochromatic, and it can be heterochromatized itself also or not. So if it is heterochromatized, if you have phenotype, you have this guy is not on. Okay, so it's the story. Note that this phenotype will happen So you can have spreading or not spreading of the chromatin in different cases, but this will become stable, okay? So after the establishment of these two possible conditions, this kind of condition is stable for, let's say, they calculated in the yeast, more or less 20 generation. Okay, so you have a stable phenotype for many, many mitoses. This is the cause, okay? So what happens is here, to make a resume of what we said, is that usually you have a heterochromatin like centromeric or telomeric or whatever, and then you have a barrier. We encountered already this barrier. We called it insulator. It's the same barrier or insulator or whatever, same term. Okay, so you have a region of the genome that contains something that actually stops this kind of spreading. Okay, and usually the genes are here; they can be expressed. Okay, euchromatic. Then when you have a chromosome translocation, okay, you actually delete this part with a barrier, so the heterochromatin will be directly adjacent to the euchromatin genes, okay? So at this point you have this spreading is possible, and you have different cells. So the three columns that you see here are different situations, three different cells, okay? In this cell, actually the chromatin is not spreading, okay? So the genes are more or less expressed, more or less euchromatic. I mean, you have a very little spreading, only to one region, okay? Here you have a large spreading, and it involves gene 1, gene 2, gene 3, and blah, 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 okay? And this is the no spreading at all, so you have no involvement of any of the genes, okay? And this is completely stochastic, okay? So you have fluctuation of the enzymes and whatever from cell to cell, and this is a general concept. Okay, the cells are never all exactly the same. They are stochastically distributed. And so you have this kind. And this is the phase of establishment. So you have a phase in which this is possible, this spreading is possible. But then, after that, okay, so this is the first phase of this embryonal development. And then you have a phase in which the genotype, the epigenotype that you establish is conserved with the mechanism that we studied on Monday. Okay, so wherever there is a heterochromatic region, it will be reproduced again and again. So all the cells that derive from this originary cell will have exactly the same story. And this is the reason why you have patches of cells. Okay? Can you follow? So you have original few cells, they go through the establishment phase, and one of them decide to be heterochromatic, the other decide not to be heterochromatic, blah blah blah. This is established. Then they proliferate, of course. And at that point there is the maintenance phase in which the epigenotype is maintained, and so you have patches. Otherwise you will have a pink distributed color. Okay? So this actually is a, as you can see, this has been worked out 50 years ago. So it's a really old story, but it has taught to us that two different phases exist during development. And this is really very fundamental to biology. So one of the problems is where heterochromatin starts from. So where, what is the cis? Intended, the cis means the sequence of DNA that tells the cell make a heterochromatin, okay, determinant. And what are the transfactors that will bind and operate?
Yeah. Excuse me, can I ask a question about these letters?
Sure.
Does the barrier contain like CTCF?
Many of those. Okay. Yeah, many of those
so
CTCF.
Insulators.
Yeah. Okay. But there are many other different proteins also, okay. So depending on the context.
Okay.
Let's see. Again, the answer to this question, what are the determinants, what are the transfactors, come again from very old, simpler models. Okay, why yeast? Because they are simpler, they have small genomes. A genome of Saccharomyces cerevisiae is 12 million, so it's a really small genome. Okay, it's easy to study. And they have less regulators, of course, so less lower number of transcription factor machinery and whatever, okay? And especially they have a very high rates of homologous recombination. So you can manipulate the genome in very easy. Okay, to introduce genes, to remove genes, make mutation is very easy in the yeast. So that's it. And so there are three models that are older studied, telomeric heterochromatin in cerevisiae, mat locus in cerevisiae, and then the syndromeric heterochromatin in spombit, that is another yeast. Okay, so let's show you very quickly. This is the telomeric situation we talked already about a little bit. So this is the very end of the chromosome, okay? And this is the telomeric repeat. You remember that telomeres have a microsatellite, okay? Of the so a microsatellite repeat. And these are bound by Rab1 protein in yeast, not in our, okay? We have the different situation. So this Rab1 will bind to a trimeric protein that is composed of these guys here, SIR2, SIR3, and SIR4. This SIR2 is a histone deacetylase. Okay? And as you can see, when the telomeric repeat ends, so here starts the normal sequence of the chromosome, you don't have any more this Rab1 proteins bound to it, but you start to have normal nucleosomes of it. Okay? So these are normal nucleosomes, story. And you see that like this because they are heterochromatic, so they are, you remember the 30 nanometer fibers. And as you can see, these proteins continue to bind. So this SIR protein, they bind to the Rab1, but also they bind to the histones. So they continue binding, okay? And since this guy here, the SIR2, is a deacetylase, it will remove all the acetylation to histones, right? So if you know very well, more than me, that if you remove acetyl groups from histones, they become heterochromatic, okay? So all these guys there, they become heterochromatic, okay? For the activity of SIR2. But the question is, do we have a boundary as we told before, okay, in yeast there is no boundary here. And the length of this situation is just determined, okay, so it's just determined by the amount of SIR protein available in the cell. So you may have more or less extension of this heterochromatin, okay, depending on the quantity of SIR. And this has been proven because you can transfect the yeast with an additional SIR2 or SIR3 or SIR4, you can see that the heterochromatin will extend. Okay, so it's just a quantity story. In this case, okay. So let's formalize a little bit this situation. So you have what? You have a silencer, let's say, so the determinant is this repeat, okay? The repeating sequence of DNA here is a silencer, okay? Rab1 will be the specificity factor, so a protein which recognizes the silencer element, okay, cis and trans, okay. Then you will have a protein that we call effector, of course, that is the enzyme, okay, the histone deacetylase. And a bridging protein that is SIR4 that actually is the bridging component. Okay? Good. Please note that this SIR3 will bind to deacetylated H4K16 prevalently. Okay? So this is a reader, let's say a reader. And this is histone deacetylase with preference to H4K16. So this is exactly the situation of reproduction of the patterns that we saw on Monday. Okay, enzyme writer that is associated with a reader of the same modification, so that we reproduce exactly the same story. Okay? So that's the story. Please note that this SIR2 protein is one of these special histone deacetylase that we talked about that doesn't use water as was normal, but it uses NAD. Okay? And this is why, for example, in yeast, if you are in very good growth condition, so you have a rich medium in which you place this yeast, you have a large extension of this. And if you starve the yeast, you will reduce the length of chromosomes of the heterochromatin. That's very curious. Something linked to the metabolic state or whatever. Anyway. Let's go further. So the second model is the mating locus. Okay, the mating locus. Do you know that? Have you never heard about the mating locus in yeast? No. Well, our friends is they have sexes. You know that. No? You don't know. It's like kind of curious. We have to. I'm sorry. This will probably make us losing a little time. Anyway, okay. The yeast are diploid. Okay, like we are. Diploid. Okay. Two copies of chromosome per cell, and they usually grow in this condition wherever you have good. Nutrient and temperature in the milieu. Okay, when they are happy, they grow as diploid. Okay, then it happens that they go through starvation. In the lab, it's very easy. You just remove the medium, they go to starvation. And so what happens is that they go through meiosis. Okay, exactly as we do in our testes or ovaries. Okay, so you have double division. And you make single haploid cells. Okay, these haploid cells are two types because they have a little different genome. Okay, and they are called A and alpha type. Okay, and then they can reproduce as haploid. But when the conditions the milieu is better, they go through conjugation. That is exactly what we do with the zygote. Okay? And so the two nuclei fuse and they recover the diploid states and they start to grow happy and glad again. Okay? So that's the cycle. And actually, there is one very singular thing here. So until there, it's exactly the same that happens in the human. But there is a single, very little story here, that this is adaptation. Because whenever you have starvation, probably most of the cell will die because they just don't need, so they don't have energy. Okay, they die. And it happens that you have single A phenotype or single alpha phenotype cells. How they can manage to become, again, a diploid. That's a very important problem. And there is a phenomenon that is called the mating time switch. In other terms, alpha cells can become an A cell, and the A cell can become an alpha cell. How does it happen? This, of course, is not genetic. They do not differ from the genetic content. Okay, it's just a question of, let's say, heterochromatin and duplication, local duplication. So there is one region in the chromosome that is called the mating type loci, in which, look at this, you have cassettes. Cassettes means that you have two or three genes inside, okay? So small region of DNA. That is alpha type or A type, okay? So in a mating type alpha cell, haploid, okay, you have two copies of this alpha cassette, okay? While in the mating type A, you have two copies of the A cassette, only one copy of the alpha cassette. But why they express alpha proteins and genes, and why they express our genes. Just because this region here in the gray shadow is completely heterochromatic, okay? And this region here on your right is completely heterochromatic, and the only region that is completely euchromatic, so can be expressed, is the one in the middle. Okay? So these guys will express alpha genes, and these guys there will express A gene. Okay? Now, they have the possibility to convert. There is a recombinational event when they are really stressed, okay? They can switch type, and it's not a genetic content difference, just they replicate this cassette and substitute the central one for this one. Okay, so they go to A to alpha to A or alpha or A to alpha. Okay, this changes the middle cassette. Okay, this is a genomic recombination phenomenon. Okay, so okay, they are genes and they will determine the phenotype. Don't look at through this slide is too much. But the problem is that, of course, you have a small region in the chromosome of the yeast in which you have heterochromatin, and euchromatin. So it's an ideal model to study how they are separated, how they work, and so on. So this is the region of the right side of the cassette. Okay. You have here, you have two genes, A2 and A1, okay, this is 1 kb. And you have, as you can see, you have two silencers. This is E and this is I. And they actually spread the chromatin there, okay? So they have the cause of chromatization of this region. And then why this doesn't spread on the right side, why this doesn't spread on the left side? Because we have boundaries or silencer or whatever, okay? So they have region that will isolate this chromatin over there. Okay. So this is an ideal model to study. In the other left side of the cassette, of the loci, you have similar situation. You have alpha 1, alpha 2, and then again you have... this is a mixed determinant end border, okay? So it just spread in the left side, and this just spread on the right side. So you have heterochromatization of this region, not on the left, not on the right. Okay, so you have this kind of situation. And this is very easy to study. And as you can see here, there are a very similar situation to what we have saw on the telomeric context. We have Rep1 protein that binds to a DNA element. So this is the specificity factor. This is the silencer, this is the specificity factor. This Rep1 is accompanied by other two proteins, ORC and ABL1, okay, that bind to the DNA. So these are specificity factors because three proteins, but again, you find SIR2, SIR3, SIR4, the same as before, okay? The same story, also SIR1 here. This is a bridging protein because it connects this ORC protein to the other ones, all right? And the SIR2 is the effector, so it does remove acetylation from histones in a progressive way, exactly as before, okay? This is spreading, okay? Exactly the same model. Why it was so, just a comment on the methodology, why it was so easy to study this 50 years ago, not 50, but 20, 25 years ago. Why it was so easy? Because the in yeast, it's very easy to make homologous recombination. Do you know what is homologous recombination? More or less. Okay, you have a DNA piece in which you have the same sequence as a region of the chromosome, and you have a double crossover, okay? So you can insert your new DNA and remove the other one, okay? Double crossover. Okay? It is driven by homology of the sequences. This is why you call homology. Okay. This is the same story you can do in man and mouse. Actually, when you make a knockout in mouse, you exactly use the same technology. So you have you take two flanking regions identical to a chromosome region you want to target, and then try to make homologous recombination. The problem is that in mouse, man, so human, men, women, same. You have a very low rate of recombination. So when you make this kind of experiment, you have to select the few cells that carried the recombination event. Okay, so you have to make selection like neomycin or whatever to select the cells, and then so this makes the story a little more difficult. In yeast, it's very high rate. So whenever you put a piece of DNA with homology sequence, it will recombinate. So you can use this guy with a reporter gene. Like, for example, in yeast, it's very easy to put the beta-galactosidase enzyme, because you remember that when you feed the cells with the X-gal, you remember X-gal is a pre-dye. Okay, so if the cell express big beta galactosis, it will color in blue. So you can see the colonies becoming blue, and this will be recombinant or not. Okay, so it's very easy to do it. So you make a cassette in which you have homologous sequences. That means the same sequences that you find in a region of the chromosome, on the left, and another region on the right side of your reporter gene. Okay, and then you make recombination. So you, for example, if you choose this region as homologous regions, this is the left side of the mating locus, the gene will go there, so will be placed inside here. If you, okay, like this. Wow. Got it. Okay, so on the other side, so this since this is a heterochromatic region, the gene won't be expressed, okay? So no color, the colony will be white. On the contrary, if you, sorry, this is repeating the same story. Motion. Okay. So, if you, on the contrary, if you use a different sequence, like taking this sequence here and this sequence here, you will place the beta gal reporter on this region that is euchromatic. Then it will be on, and the colony will be blue. And this is really very, very easy to do. And this is the reason why. Sorry, this is, works like maybe it works, maybe it works, doesn't. Okay, I didn't. Adjourned. Okay, anyway. So looking at these model systems that we have, all model systems, we can conclude something. We can conclude that to carry on heterochromatization, we need this element. So we need a DNA element that we can call silencer, if you want. Okay. That is the DNA determinant of silence, of heterochromatization. A molecule that will, a molecule or more than one molecule, I mean, it's a concept, it's not a molecule recognizing this element, and we call specificity factor, right? Then we will have one or more bridging protein, okay? And then we will have at least one chromatin-competent enzyme that will start this kind of modification. Good. So try to, if we go to the, this was in yeast, if we go to a more general model that will include not only the telomeres or centromeres or whatever, and not going only to yeast, but also considering mammals and whatever organisms, so you can generalize and say, okay, a DNA element that we can call can be actually any region of the DNA which has a specificity for some protein. And how do we call in general a protein that binds to a specific DNA sequence? We call it transcription factor. Okay? So this silencer can be generalized and say, okay, this is a transcription factor binding site. Then the second element, a molecule will recognize in this DNA element, the specificity factor will be transcription factors, more generally speaking. The bridging protein will be usually in the common molecular biology language, we say that's a co-regulator. It's a protein that will co-regulate the effect of a transcription factor. And finally, a chromatin competent enzyme that begins the heterochromatization. Now, in most of the systems that we have analyzed in mammals or in other organisms, it's usually this complex that you know, PRC2 complex, that will input one of the more dynamic and initial heterochromatization event, that is the, you remember, H3K27 methylation. Okay, and this is the probably the initial events in the story. Okay. So now we have to start another chapter. I'm sorry because we are a little early, so we could probably make an interval, but it's too early. So just let me start the story, then we stop after a while. The story is just to bring this kind of concept that we have now in mind, that is, one, this establishment of heterochromatin, and the second one is the maintenance that we studied on Monday. So what is it written in the region is reproduced during mitosis. Try to put it together, because the big question is how, where, and when chromatin is established during a life cycle. So if you consider any organism, you can consider the yeast, of course, but it's probably better to consider something more difficult like a mouse or a human, okay? So when, how, and where you have chromatin established in the life cycle, and what is this chromatin establishment you can call programming, okay? And so, do we have events of programming during differentiation, development, and whatever, and do we have also reprogramming? That means a program is erased and you make another one, okay? So this is as I told you, is a very important problem, because of course it takes all the phases of life, of course, how the genome is used in different phases of life, and also, of course, in disease, because whenever you have a disease, and you will learn it, several examples during the last part of this course, you will see several examples in which actually a disease has this kind of malfunctioning, of dysfunctioning of these phases. Okay. So the mechanisms, how are different chromatin domains established? Through pre-existing epigenetic mark, that means, of course, transgenerational programming. We mentioned this phenomenon last Monday. Of course, the DNA sequence, we have just seen it in the beginning. Stage and tissue specific transcription factors that are the transacting factors. The maintenance, we know everything. Epigenetic marks, inheritance, and local spreading, we have learned about it. And finally, reprogramming. So how can chromatin domains be reprogrammed? Specific combination transcription factor, erasure of Eastern marks, and CpG methylation. So erasure of the, essentially, of the epigenetic marks. Okay. But this is the story. Now, I took all the story from this review. I don't give you as a textbook, because it's a little complicated, in the sense that if you look through this review, you will see many, many citations of many, many papers, not really easy as a reading. But I can just suggest you to read at least the first page, as a suggestion, because it's actually much better than what I am saying to you today. I didn't put as a textbook, but okay, it's a suggestion. Okay, I put in the bibliography. Sorry. Actually, this Amanda Fisher is one of the most eminent scientists in the field. Okay. This is probably an Italian girl working in UK. fuga dei cervelli. Anyway, okay, the main subject is the story that you, of course you have the different phenomena, cell division, and maintenance, and programming is whenever a cell acquires different phenotype, different differentiation. Okay, this is the story, and as you remember, many of these stories go through different precursors. So you can have the directly stem to differentiated, but usually you have precursors inside. Okay. So let's see the one of the boxes in this review was the experimental approach for in vitro ray programming. And this just let me discuss a little bit about those experiments, and then we go through the in vivo situation. So as you know today, there is a, you probably know better than me because you had a cell biology course, and I didn't, so maybe. Anyway, you know that there is a big interest in this kind of reprogramming of somatic cells. And actually you have very different approaches that we can reconduct to three different lines. One is the somatic cell nuclear transfer, like in the dolly, famous dolly shape, right, that was converted. So this is to take a nucleus from a somatic differentiated cell and to put it back to a denucleated oocyte, so an oocyte in which you removed its nucleus, and so the nucleus of the somatic cell goes to the oocyte, and then you have a reprogrammed cell here. So this nucleus will direct complete development. Okay. And this was one of the first experiments made. Actually, the very first one was made something like 50 years ago in amphibians. I don't remember the source. I don't remember the source of the nuclei. But anyway, it was exactly this. Especially because, as you know, amphibians have a big oocyte, so it's quite easy to make this kind of transfer. And actually, this has a lot of importance, conceptual importance, because here you have a completely differentiated nucleus in which chromatin, of course, has decided already, heterochromatin, chromatin, blah, blah. But then when it goes to a novel cytoplasm, because here you just have a novel cytoplasm, it is completely reprogrammed, so it can go back to a completely undifferentiated state, okay, totipotent, because you can get a complete organism from here. So you go back to the embryonal first stages, right, of chromatin, you can reprogram completely. And this is due only to factors coming from the cytoplasm. This is very interesting. So it is the cytoplasm factor that will tell the nucleus how to manage this heterochromatin and euchromatin. This is very important, extremely important, because especially today, because we are programmed to understand everything through DNA. Okay, this is true, of course. Yes, of course, it's important. But you may have determinants that are contained in the cells, in the cytoplasm. Okay, so of course you don't change the genetic content by cytoplasm, you just change the epigenetic content, it's different. Oh, the second model was the cell fusion experiment. So you take two cells, one is a stem cell, the other one is a differentiated somatic cell, and you fuse them. There are many, many ways to fuse two cells together. I don't know how. But cell biologists don't know how. They use polyethylene glycol or something like this. Anyway, the cell fuse, and they stay for a while with a few distinct nuclei as in the zygote. Okay, this is called a heterokaryon, and then after a while they refuse the two genomes, they become a tetraploid cell here, of course, because they are diploid plus diploid will become tetraploid. But these are totipotent again. So It's very similar to those that you see here. Okay. And then the final, that is the most modern and probably is the most exciting of the experiments, is that you can reconvert the somatic cell just with a mix of transcription factors. So you take a somatic cell wherever, this probably you know this experiment, right? You discuss it in cell biology? Yeah, maybe. And you transfect. This is actually an infection because, of course, to be very efficient as a transfer of genes, you usually use lentiviral vectors or something like this. And you transfect usually four transcription factors like NanoG, OCT4, SOX2, blah blah. Okay, and then you force the expression of in these cells, and you get these iPCS that are induced. What is the name? Please help me. I don't remember. IPCS. Sorry.
Stem cell.
Right. Okay. So it's and this is partially, but because okay, this process is very is efficient, but not that much. Okay. So you don't get exactly a embryonal cell, let's say. Okay. It's partially. Not important, okay? And this is not due to the fact that you cannot get this story with transcription factor. It's probably due to that we didn't identify all the factors needed to it. Okay, so probably research continues, of course, and so we can probably find the story. And this has enormous impact on medicine, as you know. Whenever you use embryonal cells is not proposed, cannot be proposed in as a medicine treatment. But if you can reconvert somatic cell, of course you can. That's very interesting. Anyway, so these are the reprogramming of chromatin, and that actually are the experimental stories. But we have also in vivo stories. Okay, sorry, this is just a reminder that ES cells, they have undifferentiated chromatin differentiated in somatic cells. Nothing to do. So the story is to explore chromatin modification in the life cycle of mammals. Okay? And probably we can have the interval now because it's we have to concentrate on this story after that. Okay? Okay. So going through our second part, this exploring chromatin determination during the life cycle in mammals, that closer to us, probably more interesting than in East, even though never know. And just you told me that you are interested in microbiology, so probably you are more interested in East than in human. Okay, good. So, the life cycle of CpG methylation. So we examined first methylation, okay, CpG methylation. So we have to, this is a cycle, so we have to start somewhere. Let's start with a somatic cells that are actually out of the cells, and means that here you have all the cells that are in the adult organism, that are not germinal. Okay? When I say somatic cell in an organism, I mean all the cells that are not in the are not germ cells. Okay? So in these somatic cells you have methylation and maintenance of methylation, as we have learned before. Okay, so you have different kinds of stories going on. But when you go to the concept of life cycle, of course you have to consider what happens to the germinal cells, because they are the only cells that we have some importance with the new organism. Okay, so look at the PCG cells and just think about this story. Somatic cells should be methylated or unmethylated depending on their function in the different places of the genome. Okay. But in this PGC, that means the precursor germinal cells, the precursor of the germinal cells, what it means is the precursor of oocytes precursor of spermatocytes, okay? Precursors, something has to be to happen, because of course you have determination to become PGC, right? So during development you have to establish something in the chromatin that tells the cells, okay, you are a PGC, you are not a somatic cell, okay? But then when you produce spermatozoids or oocytes, you have to make totipotent chromosomes. Can you follow me? Okay, so in this phase, you have to reprogram everything, okay, and to zeros the story, okay? And this is followed by a very wide demethylation. Okay, so during the production of during gametogenesis and so on, you have a strong demethylation. Okay. Then you have sperm and eggs, and of course you have fertilization, and this is the start of a new life. You have the zygote, okay, and in the zygote you still have some methylation. Why? Because of course, even though we say you have to zero the differentiation, actually spermatocytes and oocytes, they are cells, they are different, and they have a determination to be spermatocytes or oocytes, okay? So they have some mark in the chromosome saying, I am an oocyte, I am a spermatocyte, right? So when you make a zygote, you have to reach the complete totipotence here, because this is the single cell that will give rise to all the different phenotypes. So you have another round of profound demethylation here. You see, I put it two times just to signal that you have really very heavy demethylation in this phase. And so we have the first cell divisions, right? So you go to the 2-cell stage, the 4-cell stage, the 8-cell stage, blah, blah. Okay? And here you have complete piazza pulita. Okay, so you have made complete zero of the marks. Actually, I say something, but I also say something wrong, because it's not a complete. You will see in the next lesson that we have still some places in the genome that will conserve, will have the modification. Then you have implantation, of course, okay? And at this point you have all this de novo methylation, so you re-establish all the methylation patterns and profiles that are typical of the somatic cells, okay? And go back to the site. So this is the site, okay? Now let's look at a little more detailed story, okay? So this figure is taken from this Canton and Fischer review that I presented you a few minutes ago. So you have the zygote here with the two pronuclei that still have to fuse, and then you have the formation of, through different stages of course, you have the formation of this blastocyst, in which you recognize already the primitive endoderm here, the epiblast that will give rise of course to the embryo proper. And this tropoectoderm that will give rise to the placenta and all extra embryonal tissues. Okay. And here you have DNA demethylation, and you have also another good phenomenon, that is especially when you have a female 2X genotype, in which, as you remember, female usually have 1X that is completely inactivated, okay, and the other one is active. And during this phase, you have X reactivation. So all the X are become totipotent again. Okay, so you have again the reactivation, and this is connected to the very deep demethylation. Everything. Okay. Now you go to this stage, the blastocyst, and then here, just note that here you can take embryonal stem cells, the normal ESC cells that you always encountered in cell biology. They can be cultured, and then they can be re-implanted, as you know, in a novel pseudo-pregnant mice too. to give rise to a novel organism. So they are really totipotent themselves here. And you can manipulate in vitro. There are many experiments that will do this. Yes, cells. Okay. And then you have implantation. So you go to post-implantation here. And this is just the day of post-implantation the day of development in mouse. And at this point, you have already differentiation of the PCG precursors. So you have already cells that actually are already committed to become PGC precursors. So these are the only cells that will continue to make cycles in the future. Okay. All the other cells will become either extra-embryonal tissues or embryo proper. So they will become somatic cells in the future. Okay. And of course, here, since you have differentiation of different kind of cells, you have methylation back. So you have a round of methylation in different places, whatever here. Then at this point you have the following development, and you can recognize the embryo already here. You have a very close to the end of pregnancy in the mouse, because you have 13.5 here. And as you can see, this followed by migration of these precursor germ cells to the gonads. So the PGC cells migrate and populate the gonads here. Okay. And here again, you have the possibility of culturing cells. They are called embryonic germ cells, so EGC. You can culture these cells, and again, they are pluripotent. Why? If you take all the other cells here, they are no longer totipotent. Okay, so you can. These are totipotent. Okay, but if you go to day 6.5 and you take any of these cells here, the epiblast or whatever, or trophoblast or whatever, they are not totipotent anymore. But if you take EGC cells before migration, because when they go there, they are already committed. Okay, before they are again, they are totipotent again. So why, in your opinion? That's an important question. It's an important question because it means that during this phase, from here to here, you have differentiation. Okay? So you have establishment of chromatin profiles. Then when you go there, you have a phase in which you can get totipotent cells. So it means that the heterochromatin profile are erased. Okay, so there is a phase in which these cells here that are committed already, they are reprogrammed in this phase. And they actually become real precursors of the germ cells. At this point, there is the famous demethylation that you saw in the slide before, and they are back to be totipotent again. Okay, send this, you will give to the adult. Don't see the adult here. And, okay, the adult will produce a sperm and oocytes, and you have back the fertilization and that. Okay. So let's look a little bit on the this CpG methylation biochemistry, just to make the point. Look at this next six slides will be in parentheses, okay, right? Just to remember something of the biochemistry of CpG methylation. We didn't talk in good detail before, so just let's see what is methylation. You know very well what is methylation. This, you see that slide several times, no worry. And then just look at the enzymes. Okay, the enzymes are the NT1, that is the maintenance enzyme. This is expressed all the time in all cells. Why the NT3A and 3B? They are de novo methyl transferases. And they actually are expressed only sometimes, not always, sometimes indeed. Okay, then there are other homologous like the MT3L that actually encodes a non-enzymatic protein, but it's a cofactor, okay? It binds to unmethylated H3K4 and with the
DAC1, that is the acetylase. Then there is a fourth homologue of DMBD2 that has very little activity. But anyway, we'll discuss that in the future. So just take this notion that you have a constitutive enzyme and facultative enzymes. Then what is the methylation you know very well? It's a methyl transferase started from SAM. Okay, so you get the methylation over there. Remember that always you have to have a guanine before, otherwise it doesn't work. And then how the demethylation happens, so how you can remove methyl groups. There are many ways, many different ways to do it. One is this this reaction here, that is the so-called deamination pathway, in which you have deamination here, you get uracil, okay, that becomes then thymine, or you can have, if you start from a hydroxy group on the methyl group, okay, you can go to this 5-hydroxymethyluracil, and then this can be removed by, for example, by a BER, so that by a base excision repair system or something. The other way is this in this oxidative pathway, in which actually you have a conversion of the methylcytosine to hydroxymethylcytosine. Okay, this is just the first oxidative step of a methyl group. All right, then you can go, and this is catalyzed by this TET enzyme. This goes to hydroxy form, so you will have 5-hydroxymethylcytosine, and then another TET enzyme will oxidate again this group and go to 4-methyl. Okay, this is a 4-methyl group. Can you recognize it? Okay, and then you have an additional TET enzyme that makes the further step in oxidation. You have a carboxy group here. You can see that. Okay, so now everybody will think that you may get back the normal cytosine just by decarboxylation, right? You probably know from biochemistry several decarboxylation reactions, so this is normal. We never identify the reaction like this one. So this is the reason why you see decarboxylation with an interrogation point, because we never... this is the, let's say, the most easy way to go, but actually we never identify the enzyme capable of doing this. So who knows, maybe this is a possible way to go back to the normal cytosine. Okay, but there is another possible way, that is the deformylation. So some authors published something that is a deformylation. But actually nobody knows if this is just a two-step enzyme, okay, going through carboxy and then decarboxylating, or directly deformylating. I mean, okay. To make the story short, you have an oxidative pathway, that is this one, okay, or a deamination pathway that then will be repaired by BER, so by base excision repair, that is the normal repair system in the cell. Okay. And they are the two main stories. And then you can have this kind of dilution effect. I mean, if you don't activate the DNMT1 enzyme, that is the replication competent enzyme, you inhibit its action, and you go through several mitoses, you will have dilution of the methyl group. So finally, after several division, you lose the methylation. Okay? So these three phenomena. Okay, remember also that CpG methylation is usually repressive. Okay, usually, not always, but usually it's repressive. And repression is given by two phenomena. One is to occlude regions to certain transcription factor. There are transcription factors that can be inhibited to bind their element of DNA whenever the C is methylated, okay? Or second action, to recruit proteins that contain a domain that is called the methyl DNA binding domain, okay? So, and the final story is that you have to keep in mind that CpG metabolism enzyme are usually associated with chromatin competent rider erasers and readers such as histone deacetylases and histone methyltransferases. Okay, so two quick steps. First effect, to avoid transcription factor binding to a region. Second effect, to travel with different enzymes, okay? Corepressor, like histone deacetylases, whatever. Okay, this methyl binding protein binds to modify the residues. There exist many of those. I had this kind of this line just to signal one of those, because there is one of those. Okay, this one, this MeCP2, that is important for neurological diseases because it's mutated in several neurological diseases. So just to tell you, this is one of the MBD containing proteins. All right, MeCP2. Okay, we can go after this parenthesis, just to point out how the methylation works. We can go back to our early embryo and see what happens again. So let's see just the very first phases. And the very first phase has been fertilization. The zygote with the two pronuclei and then the two-cell embryo. Okay, so very early, very early. Okay, and just to point out that here you have DNA replication starts here, okay, and then that these genomes are silent for this phase, and you start to have genome activation after the two cell embryos. Okay, so the genome here is not expressed at all. Okay, it starts to be expressed here. So this gray bars that you see means that starting from here you have gene reactivation. Now look at what happens to different marks, so different components of the chromatin. And very interestingly, there is a complete asymmetry in between the male genome and the female genome. So when we look at the methyl status before, we were considering everything together, right? In the first slide I showed to you. But now we are able to distinguish between the male genome and the female genome. So the men, women, okay? Mother, father. So look at this. There are several modifications you can look through, okay? And first of all, look at these protamines. Do you know what protamines are?
Are proteins that substitute histones during spermatogenesis to...
Do you agree? Do you agree? No? Not really. Okay, during spermatogenesis, the very final step of spermatocyte production, there is the almost complete loss of histones, okay? And these histones are replaced by a different kind of protein that is called protamine. Okay? This allows more intense compaction of the genome, because this guy, this spermatocyte, has to have a very small compacted, to be small, to make the oocyte. In other words, okay? And so the proteins are there, of course, because here we have the sperm going there. And here, as you can see, the protamines are completely off. So after the fertilization, all the protamines go away. Okay, and you start to have normal chromatin in some sense. Okay, so it's very abrupt substitution. And in fact, if you see to all other modification, to H3, H4, H3K27, H3K9, they start to appear here. Okay, this acetylation start to appear here, and then goes through the development. H3K27Me3, that is the repressive mark here, and H3K9Me2, that is the most stable repressive mark starting here. Okay. Then take a look of the 5MC. So this is the methyl cytosine. The methyl cytosine are a little present here, but as I told you before, during the zygote production, they go away completely. Okay? And we can take a look of the first product of the oxidative pathway. You remember the slide before, that is the hydroxymethyl cytosine. And you see that at the same time, this disappears, you have production of 5H methyl cytosine. So it means that the text oxidation on the main genome is the prime method of conversion of the methyl cytosine to hydroxycytosine and then to eliminate. Okay? Good. One important question is, since I told you that there is no transcription here, no transcription, okay? So the genome of the man, let's say man, let's say father, is completely off, and the genome of the mother is completely off. Where do these histones? I told you that this, in the paternal genome, in the male genome, there is only protamines, okay? No histones. And as you remember, the spermatocyte is a nucleus, and there is no cytoplasm virtually. So it's okay. So where do histones come from?
The mother.
Cytoplasm of the mother is the only way to explain it. I mean, no transcription. So you have no novel production of histones, right? But you get back the histones, because this is chromatin structure. So it means that the histones that reorganize, this is an important concept in biology, in mammal biology especially, okay, means that the histones that make the chromatin of the male genome actually came from the mother. Okay? So, this is also the reason why oocyte is so big. There is a lot of histones, a lot of storage in there, and there's all the materials needed to make back a chromatin from a DNA. Okay? And that's it. Then look at the female genome. It's a different story, because the female genome was already, before fertilization, in its own media, okay? Its own cytoplasm. So, looking at the histones, you have acetylation of histones is going to be progressively reacquired, and this is very similar to the paternal genome, actually. And then you have this 27K methylation that is present all through the early developmental stages. That means that this makes a difference from the paternal. Paternal has no this modification, also because there's no histone. Of course, impossible to have a modification without a subset. But this is kept. Okay, so it means that in the oocyte, this modification was already present and is kept all the through the initial phases. Okay, and then you have this K9. Again, it was already present, and it just goes away a little bit in the 2-cell stage here. Okay, then look at the 5-methyl cytosine. This is quite important, because as you consider, this is kept for a much longer time than in the male genome. So again, together with the K27 and K9 in parallel, you keep the same methylation that you had before. Okay, and then you have a dilution phenomenon here. So no tech oxidation, you just have dilution, because here you start to have 2 sets, then 4 sets, blah blah. So this results probably from the blocking of the normal DNMT1 activity, but actually this is a debated story, because nobody really knows if you have also participation of the oxidation pathway or not. So it's, okay. kind of discussion. Anyway, the take-home message from this slide is that you have a marked asymmetry in the two genomes, right? So the genome of the paternal origin is completely empty of information, or almost completely empty of information. Why? Actually, the genome of the mother has epigenetic information. Okay. Good. Now let's look back to the circle we saw before. Okay. So this is visible. This asymmetry is visible up to the fourth cell stage. So after two rounds of division. Then, as you probably remember, in mammals, you have not this rule of 2 by 2 by 2. You just keep the 2 by 2 rule until the 8 cells, then you lose it, because the rate of division is different from one side to the other side. The maternal genome maintains epigenetic marks, and methylation retained, blah, blah, and so on, and the paternal is not. So this is reason, and this is the situation before pronuclear fusion, and this kept for the few divisions. Okay, this is the story. Okay, so now you have the beginning of re-establishment of the marks. Okay, so when you arrive at this story here, you have re-establishment of the marks in chromatin, because, of course, as we told before, there is differentiation, okay? This is differentiation. Okay, endothelium, epiblast, trophoblast, or whatever. So they are already differentiated. You have a round of DNA methylation, histone methylation, or whatever. And then you have two big complexes of protein that play a prevalent role in this phase, that are the trithorax and polycomb group proteins. Actually, these are, as you can understand, are names that derive from Drosophila biology. Okay, trithorax means that you have three thoracic segments. This was a mutant of Drosophila, and polycomb is actually linked to the combs on the head of the Drosophila. In human, the corresponding proteins are called MLL2 and the PRC. Sorry, this was an inversion. When you know the PCR, you always say PCR. This is a PCR. It's PRC. PRC2. Okay, this is the name. Okay. Protein repressor complex 2. That's the spelling. So this, as you know, this brings out this H3K27Me3, and this other protein will bring out through this SET2-1AB protein, and through this MLL134 proteins will actually give rise to this active modification. Remember that H3K4Me3 is the active modification histone. And in the early phase of development, like in ESC, so in the early phase here, okay, you have many, many bivalent chromatin domain. Bivalent chromatin domains, you want to say, is different. Okay, and these are domains in which you have both active and both inactive repressive marks. So in some sense, there are regions in the chromatin in which you have undecided phenotype. Okay? So you have something like, say, I go, I don't know, should I stay or should I go? I'll say the song, okay, should I stay? So in the sense that they are undecided, okay? And then in the following phases, one of the two stories will prevail, and so the region will become active or completely inactive. Okay, so we are there, and this is embryonic stem cells, just to say that, of course, we can culture ES cells and differentiate in vitro. So there are many, many studies in the literature that consider this situation in ESC cells. But, of course, we have to be aware that when you culture cells, this is an in vitro model. It's not an in vivo model, of course. So you can take many of the things that you know from that as real, but always with caveat that may be representing the real situation or not. Because of course when you have an embryo, you have several cell-to-cell contacts. The epiblast cells will contact the endodermal cells, and trophoblastic cells will contact the epiblasts as well. And as you know, the cells secrete a number of growth factors and cytokines and whatever. So when you culture a cell out of the embryo, all this kind of relationship with other cells are lost. So we know, but we don't know. Again. Okay. So there are many experiments that have been done with the story. When you have cells in culture taken from the blastocyst, you can differentiate in vitro. Okay, so it's just, this is just to show the demethylation events. And so when you are here, you are at the lowest level of methylation. Then you can culture your cells, and there are many studies that actually goes through this differentiation. And as you probably know better than I do, depending on the condition and medium you put here, you have differentiation to neuron-like or to myoblast-like or to whatever. Okay. Depending on the factors that you put there. Several experiments done, but just to say you the caveat, this is not real condition, it's something like artificial condition. Go back to our embryo. And this is the embryo, and this is post-implantation. So here you have the famous PCG that are relocated to the future gonads here. Okay, and they will be the precursors here. They will start to be reprogrammed. And the start of reprogramming is around day 6.5. And they, at this point, they are already marked as somatic, of course. So they are very similar to all other cells here. But as soon as they migrate to the destination, they start losing, for example, this mark that, as you know, this is the main heterochromatin mark. And they acquire what appears is the H3K27M3. I put this slide just because we have to discuss again the different role of H3K9M3 and H3K27M3. I repeat, I told again, that this is a stable mark of differentiation. Okay, K9M2 or M3 is a stable mark of differentiation for chromatin, while this K27M3 is the dynamic mark. So this is a way we are talking about reprogramming, okay? So you have regions in the chromatin that are already completely heterochromatic. They have a K9 mark, okay? But they have to be rendered back totipotent. So they don't go directly to euchromatin. They go through K27, because K27 is the dynamic form. The K27 can be, at this point, cancelled. You will put acetyl on the K27 and go back to activity. Okay, so whenever you have reprogrammation, the heterochromatin doesn't go directly to active. It will go through this K27M3 stage, and then become euchromatic. It's the same also the other way around. You have a euchromatic region. You want to repress it. You go through this K27M3. So polycomb group proteins, okay, and then you get the final heterochromatization with K9, okay. So it's an obligatory middle step in the passage. Okay, and then of course you have the methylation in this passage here. Good. So you can also have a reprogramming here. You can measure reprogramming here. So you go through this E6 to E13.5 stage and look only at the germinal cells here, the precursor of germinal cells, and you see the modification, how they go. Okay, so K9 is lost, K27 is acquired here, histone H1 is K9-me3, K9 acetylated. This is arginine. We never talk about arginine methylation, but anyway, you can also see this R3 of histone 4 that disappears, and this is methylation that goes away, and we have rise of the hydroxy 4. Okay, so this just to demonstrate that everything is remake. Good. So let's go to the final story, that is the also this reprogramming has been studied from the point of view of chromatin, of course. Okay, so when you can do in vitro reprogramming, you can also ask whether chromatin changes. And actually, what we know from several experiments is also in vitro you need exactly the same story. So the PCR2 action is required to reprogram, so you have to go through this K27-me3. And of course, you need also the trithorax component, that is the final euchromatic steps. Okay, you need demethylation. Okay, and the a possible question is, how do you know that? Of course, making knockout of the enzymes. So you have a model in which you have cells, you reprogram with something like factors, for example, transcription factors. Okay. And you knock out, and you can knock out very transiently, like for using, for example, siRNA downregulation. Do you know siRNA? It's very easy to do. You just transfect with double-strand RNA the cells, you will downregulate the protein, and you see no more differentiation, no more reprogramming. It's very easy to do. And whenever you for example, downregulate any component of this demethylation that we have seen before, like TET enzyme, okay, you downregulate TET enzyme, you don't have any more reprogramming. So demethylation is needed for reprogramming. Okay, so this. And also there is a concept that any action that will reduce heterochromatin level will favor reprogramming. So you can make the same experiment, so you transfect the four factors, for example, and see. And then you can treat the cells the same way with any drug that reduces heterochromatin in general. There is one example that I want to just to talk to tell you about, that is this valproic acid. Do you know valproic acid? Neurobiologists should know it, because it's a very old drug that is used to treat, I think,
bipolar
disorders, yeah, kind of psychological drug. Okay, so it has also been proposed as anti-cancer drug in some application, not many. In my lab, we have used it to. Do we have time? Yes. You know that most of breast cancer cells are estrogen receptor containing, and they depend on hormone to proliferate. Okay, but some actually this is say 75%, 75% of the cell, of the breast cancer are hormone dependent, but there exists 25% that is not hormone dependent. So you can take this hormone independent breast cancer cells and look, do they have estrogen receptor? No, they do. They don't. Okay, so the reason why they do not are sensitive to estrogen, to hormones, is because they do not express estrogen receptor. And this is clear. But the question is, they do not express estrogen receptor for a very easy reason. Because in these hormone-independent cells, the estrogen receptor locus is heterochromatic. Okay? It's repressed and is heterochromatic. Okay? Can you follow the logic? Good. So I can take inhibitor of heterochromatin and try to see whether I treat a hormone independent cell and I reprogram, because with the inhibitor, and actually this valproic acid is a histone deacetylase inhibitor, so it means that progressively the cell will acquire back the acetylation, that is a phenomenon of reactivation of heterochromatin, then I can express back my estrogen receptor, and maybe that the cell becomes sensitive to hormones. Okay, so actually it is true partially, in the sense that we observe that treating a hormone-independent breast cancer cell with valproic acid and other inhibitors, you can get back expression of estrogen receptor. Okay, and if you treat these cells with that anti-estrogen, that is the normal drug for breast cancer, tamoxifen, you have anti-proliferative effect. That is quite a reprogramming story in the cancer, and it takes the use of a neurological drug with another abuse, okay, valproic acid. And the same, if you use the model of transcription factor transfection to make a reprogramming of a somatic cell, it's the same. If you treat the cells with valproic acid, okay, this will increase the efficiency of reprogramming because it reduces heterochromatin. So you increase the story. Why? When you reduce heterochromatin, you increase the possibility to have a reprogramming. Probably the explanation is probably very easy to understand. When you have heterochromatin, you have more accessibility to the transcription factors. Okay? And so since reprogramming is due to transcription factor, this is the reason. Okay? That's the story. Let's just finish my talk with a comment that is in the very last lines of this Canton and Fisher review. And it's just an important story. To date, most of the histone modification analysis in the pre-implantation embryo and PGCs have been done by immunofluorescence. Okay, so staining antibodies against H9-MeIII or K27-MeIII or whatever, and then look for that staining. And so they detect gross changes. Okay, not local changes, just a kind of general expression, not real in the specific. Okay, and why they have made? Okay, can you explain why most of the experiments have been done by immunofluorescence, not by CHIP analysis, for example? You remember yesterday we talked a lot about CHIP analysis. CHIP analysis will describe every single region of the genome that is. Why we didn't do in this case?
Because they were older experiments.
No, they are quite recent. This is a 2013 review. Not that tall. That dollar.
Are cheaper?
No. Yeah, yes, of course, but it is not the main reason.
Number of cells.
Number of cells. How many cells do you have in an embryo? One, two, three, four? That is a technical limit. Either I take an enormous number of embryos at the same stage, that is kind of very difficult, costly approach, or I have to increase my sensitivity of the assays, okay? And actually, as a matter of fact, today, for making a common CHIP analysis, we need something like at least, you remember probably the slide about ATAC-seq. We need something like 50,000 cells to have a good sensitivity. It's enormous for the embryo, okay? But progressively, we are reaching nano sensitivity to this kind of technologies. And for example, from the point of view of gene expression, that means measuring RNA expression, we are arrived to single cells analysis. Have you mentioned it in bioinformatics? Not yet. You will arrive. Okay, so today we have technology to study gene expression at the single cell analysis by NGS. Okay, we are not yet at this point for chip-seq analysis, so we still need more cells. But in the future, we will certainly have a genome-wide mapping technologies in the nanoscale. Okay. It's important, I think, not to realize why we know something and don't know anything on another subject, because it's just technical education. Okay, if you have questions, we have 5 minutes, otherwise we finished.